All right, so here we are again at the first chapter of Paul's epistle to the Romans, and we're picking up tonight in verse 5. So we've covered the first four verses of the first chapter where Paul is introducing himself. As I mentioned in the introductory study, Romans is, in some sense, it is sort of Paul's, his own theological statement, really. And his introduction here kind of sets the tone for the whole epistle. It's a very doctrinally oriented epistle, as we pointed out. The first 11 chapters are essentially doctrinal chapters. The remaining few chapters are the practical application. So even right here in the beginning, right here in the very introduction, where Paul in other epistles would normally just sort of briefly introduce himself and go right into his greeting of the people that he's writing to, and then right on into his topic, just here in the first few words, he already sort of launches into some of this doctrine and some of this deep theology that he's going to be addressing throughout the whole epistle. And so you remember, he introduces himself as Paul, a bondservant of Jesus Christ, called to be an apostle, separated to the gospel of God. Now, normally, you could kind of skip right down to verse 7, where he would say then, to all who are in Rome, beloved of God, called to be saints, grace to you and peace from God our Father and the Lord Jesus Christ. That would be a perfectly normal Pauline greeting. But again, notice he takes a diversion and he goes off into speaking about the gospel. And we talked about the gospel in our previous study. You remember we saw that it is God's gospel. And because it's God's gospel, it's not man's gospel, we are to hold it in reverence. We're not to tamper with it. We're not to adjust it. We're not to try to reinvent it. It's God's gospel, and it concerns, again, as we saw, his son, our Lord Jesus Christ. It's the gospel about the Lord Jesus Christ, who he is and what he did. And it is a gospel that was foretold in the prophets, you remember? And it's the gospel that speaks of God's Son who was born of the seed of David according to the flesh. We looked a little bit at the incarnation, but then declared to be the Son of God with power according to the Spirit of holiness by the resurrection from the dead. So we've got in there, we've got it's God's gospel. We've got the authority of Scripture, really, referring back to the Old Testament prophets. We've got the incarnation stated here. We've got the resurrection stated here. So you see, right away, Paul is into doctrine as he's writing to this church in Rome. And so now, picking up in verse 5, he says, through him, and of course he's speaking of Christ, through him we have received grace and apostleship for obedience to the faith among all nations for his name, among whom you also are the called of Jesus Christ. So Paul is speaking of himself here and the other apostles, but he says that it's through Christ that they received grace and apostleship. Now, what he's probably saying here is they received the grace to be apostles. So combining not two separate things, receiving grace and apostleship, but actually receiving the grace unto apostleship. So as Paul would point out in some of his other epistles, his calling as an apostle, he understood that to be purely by the grace of God. He understood that it had nothing to do with his own qualification. It certainly had nothing to do with his own goodness or anything like that. He completely understood that his salvation, his calling into ministry, his apostleship, all of this was because of God's grace. And of course, the same is true for us. Whatever it is that we might do, beginning, of course, just initially with our salvation, but whatever we might do in our service for the Lord, whatever he might call us to, whatever he might involve us in, you know, at the end of the day, when we look back, we would just have to say, well, you know, it was all because of the grace of God. We could never figure it out. We could never tag a reason onto it like, well, you know, God just knew that I was going to be faithful. Or God knew that I had something that he needed to get his will accomplished in the earth. If I ever start thinking like that, I'm on the wrong track. And I need to get my thinking process sorted out. It's always going to be by the grace of God that we do whatever we do. And so Paul had received grace for this apostleship. And notice now that the apostleship is for obedience to the faith among all nations for his name. So this was the apostolic ministry. The apostolic ministry was to take the gospel to the nations. And in taking the gospel to the nations, it was to produce an obedient people, a people who would glorify the name of the Lord. And so these men, the apostles, they were not stationary like pastors are. They were not settled in one particular location necessarily. They might have had sort of a home base. Paul seemed to have made his home base Antioch, but he was constantly going out, because that was the ministry of an apostle. He was to go out to the nations. Now, the word nation, when we read the word nation in our New Testament in particular, I don't think we can help but think of nations like we understand them today. But what the Bible's talking about and what we think of are not exactly the same. When the New Testament is talking about the nations, the Greek word is actually ethnos. And so we know that word from our word ethnic, right? So it's the gospel is to go out to all of the various groups of people that you would find all over the planet. Back in that time of history, there were not nations as we know them today. As the way the world is today, as we understand it, being divided up into various nations, this is a relatively new development. But back then, of course, you had various empires, and you had, generally, you had people groups that would be gathered together around their ethnicity. And so we obviously still have that to some degree today as well. But the gospel is to go out to everybody. That's the point. There's no one in the world that the gospel is not for. Now, the liberal-minded person would say, well, you know, and these are the ones that are being really nice, Christianity is for Western people. It's the religion of the West, they would say. And it's fine. You're born in the West, you ought to be a Christian. That's the religion of the West. But the East has different religious systems. And they would say, of course, all of these are equally legitimate. All of them are valid. You know, if you're born in the West, then you would naturally be a Christian. But if you're born in the Middle East, you'd probably be a Muslim, possibly. If you're born further east, you'd probably be a Buddhist or a Hindu, they would say. So in their thinking, there isn't really a need for evangelism. We don't need to go make Buddhists into Christians. We don't need for Hindus to become Christians. We don't need for Muslims to become Christians. That's a very popular attitude today among many people. But that's certainly not what Jesus said, is it? Jesus said to his disciples that they were to go and make disciples of all of the ethnic groups on the planet. And Paul is saying here that that's exactly what he was commissioned to do as an apostle. He was given grace by Jesus Christ to take the gospel message to all of the people on the earth. Now, of course, none of the apostles got to everybody on the planet, but they laid the foundation, and the work of Christ carried on beyond their generation, and the gospel continued to spread, and it continues to spread right down to this very day. And even today, there are new ethnic groups of people that are being won to Christ by missionaries, by people going out into areas where the gospel has never gone, and they're fulfilling that commission that Jesus gave. Now, I think it's interesting here that Paul uses the word obedience. Grace and apostleship for obedience to the faith among all the nations for his name's sake. He uses the word obedience, and I find that interesting because that's really the objective. The idea that you could somehow believe in Jesus but yet not obey him is foreign to the New Testament text. Obedience is, in some senses, it's really sort of a synonym with the word belief, the New Testament word belief. We often think of belief as just intellectual assent. We acknowledge that something is true mentally, but that's not biblical belief. Biblical belief is not simply the acknowledgement that something is true, but it's the embracing of that truth to the extent that it impacts my life. So what God intended the gospel to do as we receive it is transform our life, turn us from disobedient people into obedient people, turn us from godless people to becoming godly people. Turn us from unrighteous people to becoming righteous people. And so that was the mission that the Lord sent the apostles on. And Paul says to them, among whom you also are the called of Jesus Christ. Now, remember earlier, Paul talked about the fact that he had been called to be an apostle. And now he's talking to the believers in Rome about their calling to be the children of God, about their calling to be Christians. It is true that we are called. Jesus said, remember this, Jesus said, many are called, but few are chosen. What does that mean? Well, it means this. The call to salvation, or the call for salvation, has gone out to every single person. But of course, not every single person is going to respond. So the many that are called is a reference to everybody, but the ones that are chosen is a reference to those who heed the call. And so Paul here, in addressing the believers in Rome, he is confident that they are the chosen. They are the ones who have heeded the call. Later in this epistle, Paul would write these words. He would say, whom he foreknew, he also predestined. And whom he predestined, he called. Whom he called, he justified. And whom he justified, he also glorified. So you see there, foreknew, predestined, called, justified, glorified. So there's a general call that goes out to all men, but the effectual call goes out to those that he has foreknown. You see, you go back to the foreknowledge of God. God knows in advance those that will respond to his invitation of grace. And so it's those that will respond that he then predestines to be conformed to the image of his son, and it's those that he calls with this effectual call. And the effectual call could be, I think, defined as he calls you by name. He calls you by name. I mean, just think of it, you know, here, just think, we're in a multitude of people, and, you know, here you are, you're just a face in the crowd, and the call is going out. Salvation is available. It's free for anyone who wants to be saved. Come. And there you are. You're kind of just, oh, okay, salvation. Somebody's making a call. But then all of a sudden, Brian Broderson, you are called to be saved. Whoa. At that point, I'm going to stop and I'm going to listen, right? Because there's a specific call there. It's gone from the general to the specific. That is true of every believer. So we could look at it as we have been called by name. And Paul, in writing to these saints in Rome, that's what he's saying to them. He says, you also are the called of Jesus Christ to all who are in Rome, beloved of God, called to be saints. Grace to you and peace from God our Father and the Lord Jesus Christ. So Paul tells them they're called. He tells them that they're loved of God. He tells them that they're called not to be saints, but actually he says they're called saints. Notice the two little words there, to be, are italicized. And in case you don't know this, whenever you see italicized words in your Bible, those are inserted by the translators to help the flow of the sentence. And generally they do that. But here you don't even necessarily need those words, because we're not only called to be saints, we are called saints. That's what God has called us. He's called us saints. But if you think about that for a moment, really, you know, some of these things, we read them, we kind of pass by them rather quickly, we don't give a whole lot of thought to it, but, you know, if you just sit and ponder for a minute, the fact that you've been called by God, God has called you. He's called you by name. He's called you to come and be a part of his family. He's called you to come and share in the love that he has for you. He's called you, apart from this world that's perishing, to come and join him in a world that's going to go on forever and ever. I mean, that's pretty amazing stuff. But like I said, I think sometimes we can blow right past this. This is introductory stuff. We don't want to spend a whole lot of time here, but we ought to spend more time thinking about these things, thinking about who this God is, this God who's made everything that there is. He's made the entire universe. He's made us. And then he's called us to come and be part of his family. What a glorious thing. Now, in verse 8, Paul begins to now address them in Rome. He's finished now his greeting. And now he says, first, I thank my God through Jesus Christ for you all, that your faith is spoken of throughout the whole world. So Paul is letting them know right off the top that he's excited about what he hears is going on in Rome. Now, remember, we pointed this out. Paul had not been to Rome at this point. Paul did not have any involvement in the establishing of this church. As we pointed out in a previous study, we don't know who started the church in Rome. It doesn't really matter who humanly started it. We know ultimately the Lord started it. But Paul had never been there. But he had friends there. He had associates there, and he had a longing to go there, but he'd never been there. So the first thing he says to them, he says, I thank my God through Jesus Christ for you all, that your faith is spoken of throughout the whole world. So that church in Rome, everybody was talking about that church in Rome. And, you know, there are some churches where you just sense the Lord is at work. And you know what happens with those churches? The word gets out. And people start hearing all over the place. And then you go somewhere and you meet somebody and they tell you, well, I'm from such and such a church. Oh, man, I've heard of that church. Tell me about what's going on there. And that's the way it works. It kind of just spreads all around the world. Now, we happen to be part of a fellowship that has that kind of a worldwide reputation. I mean, it's amazing to me the different places I go in the world. And, you know, when people find out you're from Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa, it's almost like everybody just stops and says, what? You're from where? Did you realize that you're part of that kind of a congregation? But there's that testimony that's gone out. And there's that excitement, and there's that admiration in some sense, and there's that respect for what God's done here. And that was what was happening with the church in Rome as well. Paul had heard of all that God was doing there, and he was rejoicing. He was thanking God for their faith that was spoken of throughout the whole world. And then he says in verse 9, for God is my witness, whom I serve with my spirit in the gospel of his Son, that without ceasing I make mention of you always in my prayers. So Paul calls God to witness here. And he says something that is interesting. He says that he serves God with his spirit in the gospel of his Son. Many in Paul's day, and especially where Paul had previously been, they seemed to serve God, but they did not do it with their spirit, or they did not do it with their heart, in other words. That's what he's talking about. What Paul's really doing right here is he's essentially saying, I'm not just going through the motions. I'm not just... This thing isn't mechanical for me. This isn't just external. I'm not just caught up in rituals or duties or anything like that. Paul says, no, I do this thing with my heart. And it's significant that Paul says that because the Pharisees, of course, would have been, to a large degree, they would have been guilty of serving God not with their heart, not with their spirit. But they would have served God mechanically, externally, just keeping the rules and the regulations outwardly to look good to men, but in their hearts, they were impure and they were wicked. But Paul says, I serve God with my spirit in the gospel of his Son. It was real, in other words, to Paul. And you know what was true of the Pharisees in that day? Sadly, it's true of some people in ministry today. You could find in positions today of leadership in churches, you could find men who are there for every other reason than because their heart is in it. Some are there because it's just a job. It's just what you do. Some are there because you might get a good salary and a good retirement plan. Some are there because it makes them feel good to... benevolently reach out to people, or all different kinds of motives that people have for getting into ministry or being in ministry. Sometimes it's just sheer pride. I like having some power. I like having authority over other people. I like being looked up to. I like people to call me pastor, things like that. Some people are in the ministry for those kinds of reasons, sadly. But it wasn't the case with Paul. Paul said that he served God with his spirit. His whole heart was in what he did. And that should always be true of us. We should be serving the Lord with our spirit. We should always be serving the Lord with our whole heart, not just going through the motions. And you know, we need to guard our hearts against that, because we can slip into that. We can all slip into that at times, where we're just going through the motions. You know, I have to confess, there are times when I'm singing songs and my brain is somewhere else completely. I'm lipping the, you know, I'm lip syncing, basically. I know the words, and, you know, I'm singing, but I'm not engaging in my mind. I'm not thinking about what the words of the song are. I'm not necessarily focusing on the Lord. And I'm saying that because it's a reality for all of us. We have to constantly be checking our hearts. Wait, where am I at with this? What am I doing with this? And even sometimes when we're involved in some sort of service to the Lord, you know, if we're serving the Lord but complaining the whole time we're doing it, if we're griping about it, well, what do I have to do this for? Well, this isn't what I signed up to do. I thought I was going to get to do this other thing. I don't want to do this. Well, then you have to really ask, where is your heart at? You see, we should be doing whatever we do with a heart for the Lord. Paul would say this later in writing to the Colossians, didn't he? He said, whatever you do, do it with all your heart as to the Lord and not to men. He's talking about the same thing right here. This is what he says. He says, I serve God with my spirit in the gospel of his Son. And because he's doing this with his heart, he would then go on to say that without ceasing, I make mention of you in my prayer. You know, if you don't have a heart for the ministry, you won't pray for the ministry. You won't pray for anybody in the ministry. It'll just be mechanical. It'll just be external. You'll just show up when it's the appropriate time to show up, and you'll do that thing that everybody sees you do, and you'll feel good about it, then you'll walk away, but you won't think about it afterwards. You won't pray for the people that you ministered to. But you see, if your heart's in it, like Paul's was, he could say, I serve God with my spirit in the gospel of his Son, and go on then to say in the same breath that without ceasing, I make mention of you always in my prayers. He's a true servant of God, in other words. And so what was his prayer? Well, he prayed many things, but he mentions one specific thing here, making request, he said, if by some means, now at last, I may find a way in the will of God to come to you. So Paul was praying for them, and as he would pray for them, he would add to that prayer, Lord, let me go to Rome. I want to go there. I want to see those people. I want to reconnect with those believers I know, and I want to see those believers that I've never met face to face. Lord, I want to go see that work that you're doing there. That's what Paul was praying. And so he says, for I long to see you. I long to see you that I may impart to you some spiritual gift so that you may be established, that is, that I may be encouraged together with you by the mutual faith both of you and me. So Paul wants to go to Rome, and he wants to go there because he wants to bring a blessing to the people. He wants to go there and build them up in the faith. That's his heart. He wanted to get to Rome, not because he wanted to tour Rome. Wasn't that he wanted to go there on vacation. He wanted to go there and minister. And he had it in his heart, all of those things that Christ had taught him, all of the things that he had experienced, he wants to come and personally share these things with the fellowship in Rome. But not only that, he says, not only do I want to come and bless you, but I know that when I come, I'm going to be blessed as well. There's going to be a mutual blessing. And Paul was absolutely right. That is so often the case. we go out at times going to places thinking and hoping and longing, understandably, to be a blessing. When you go somewhere, you want to bless the people that you go to visit. But we find so often that we get more blessed than the people. We get blessed by going. We get blessed by what the Lord does through the folks that we get to have those beautiful ministry times with. Speaking of going and ministering, this weekend, if you would just keep us in prayer, John Henry and I are going to be flying to Ireland tomorrow, and we're going to be doing this very sort of thing. We're going to be ministering to the folks there, and we've been praying and planning, and I know John is, and I am as well. We're intending to go and be a blessing to the people there, but I'm absolutely certain that when it's all said and done, it will have been a mutual thing. We will have been blessed as well. So that was the heart of Paul. And again, in this, you know, as you read some of these things and as you pause and think about them a little bit, you get some insight into the person as well. And you see here that Paul is genuinely a humble man. He's an apostle. He's had a personal visitation from Christ. He's had a personal commission from the Lord to be the apostle to the Gentiles. But he's not puffed up about it. He's not thinking that he can only give, but he can't receive from anybody because, after all, he's received from the Lord. So how could anybody else possibly minister to him? Paul has a humble attitude, and he's expecting to go among these Roman believers and to be mutually edified. He's expecting that he's going to receive a blessing when he is there with them as well. And so he says in verse 13, "Now I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, that I often planned to come to you, but was hindered until now, that I might have some fruit among you also, just as among other Gentiles." So he wanted to come. It wasn't that it was a lack of desire. Quite honestly, I often say that to people because I've met people over the years that I would love to go visit them. I'd love to go to their country, or I'd love to go to their fellowship. And we talk sometimes and we'll say, "Yeah, let's do that." And right, okay, yeah, next year. Well, we'll do it next year. And then next year comes around and something comes up and we're not able to do it. And I often find myself saying to people, look, just understand, it's not a lack of desire. I would come. I would love to come. I'd go everywhere. I'd love to go everywhere. But, you know, how many places can you go? I mean, you just can't go everywhere. So, you know, Paul's saying to the church in Rome, he says, it's not a lack of desire. It wasn't like I didn't want to come to you. I've been wanting to come to you, but there have been hindrances. Things have prevented me from coming. I wanted to come to you, he says, that I might have some fruit among you also, just as among other Gentiles. So Paul just had that desire. Man, I want to go to Rome and I want to have some fruit there. I want to fellowship with those people. You know, the life of an apostle, it was kind of a two-edged sword. You know, there was that blessing, of course, of being able to go and to plant churches and to spend time nurturing those young fellowships and then to move on to other places and to, you know, just launch out into these other regions. But the other side of it, of course, was it was lonely and it was challenging. The traveling, of course, was very difficult back in those days. The accommodations were far from the things that we know today. So it had that kind of that double edge to it. And it's still the same today in some ways. Like I said, it's, you know, to go out and to meet different people and to be in places and to see. There's something about that that's wonderful, that's very attractive and alluring, but there's another side of it that's very taxing as well. There's another side of it that, you know, it could become weary. I know a few guys that spend almost their entire lives in airports and on airplanes. And I mean, I do that a little bit, and the little bit that I do it, I'm exhausted. I can't imagine going at the pace that some of these guys go. But Paul understood that there was that experience of having fruit among these various Gentile congregations spread throughout the Roman world. And he wanted to have some fruit there in Rome also. And then he says this in verse 14, he says, I am a debtor both to Greeks and to barbarians, both to wise and to unwise. Paul saw himself as a debtor in this sense. Paul felt this tremendous obligation to get the gospel to people. Paul was like a man who had discovered a cure for a previously incurable terminal disease. He was like a man who had discovered a cure, and he felt an obligation to get the message of this cure out to as many people as possible. Now, this was sort of a specific calling that Paul had. And there was an occasion where Paul would even say, woe to me if I do not preach the gospel. This was a specific calling that the Lord gave him, and he felt that. He felt indebted to lost men. He had once been lost himself, and now he has been saved, and he knows that the cure to all of man's ills, that the cure to all the world's problems lies in faith in Christ. So he feels himself under this obligation. He is a debtor, he says. And notice who he says that he's indebted to here as he's writing to the Romans. He says that he is a debtor to the Greeks and the barbarians, the wise and the unwise. Now, the question is, why does he say Greeks? The Romans certainly were not Greeks. They were Romans. But the fact of the matter is, they were Greeks culturally. You see, Alexander had so thoroughly Grecianized that part of the world that when Rome came to power, they adapted Greek culture. And so Rome was in some ways, although it was a separate empire and it didn't come directly out of Greece, in some ways, it was just an extension of Greece. So it was culturally Greek. And the Romans, although they were proud to be Romans, they thought of themselves culturally as Greeks. And of course, the Greeks thought that their culture was the best culture, the superior culture. So in other words, if you perceived yourself to be a Greek, you perceived yourself to be a part of the that special group of people, that superior group, as contrasted with the barbarians. Who were the barbarians? The barbarians were everybody who wasn't Greek. So it was as simple as that. Greek culture, we have a great illustration of it in our time today. American culture has permeated so much of the world today. You know, you go all over the world today, and even in places where the last thing the leadership wants is an American influence, it's there. We have just made our way into every nook and cranny on the planet, practically. And, you know, it's funny sometimes when you're traveling, and maybe even in more third world kinds of places, and you see the clothes that the people are wearing, and of course, a lot of times they're sort of knockoffs of, you know, the real thing. But nevertheless, they've got their designer t T-shirts on and so forth, but it's all the stuff that's being produced and promoted right here in America. And to the dismay of many leaders, as I said, American culture just sort of continues to keep, you know, pressing into these different societies. You hear sometimes that there's a lot of anti-Americanism around the world today. And sometimes people would even say, oh, you know, be careful when you're traveling, watch out. They don't like Americans over in certain parts. You know, I think that is only true on the political level. It's not true on the cultural level. It's not true on the personal level. Wherever I've gone in the world, people are happy to meet me as an American. And they want to know all about America. They want to talk about all the kinds of things that we don't even talk about ourselves. One of the great advantages that I have nowadays is I can tell people, you know, because they always ask you where you live. And, you know, trying to explain to people you live in Orange County, that's kind of a difficult thing. You say Los Angeles, most people know Los Angeles. Orange County, you kind of say it's a suburb. But you know what? I've solved the problem. This is the easiest and the best way to communicate where I live. I live just down the street from Disneyland. Everybody knows where Disneyland is. They've either been there or they have, you know, they've read about it, they've heard about it, they've seen it on the internet. They know where Disneyland is. So if you're ever struggling to let somebody know where you live, just tell them you live near Disneyland and that will solve the problem. So it's a similar thing. The Greek culture had just dominated that part of the world at that time. And so everybody outside of the Greek culture were considered barbarians. And the word barbarian came from the way the Greeks heard these other non-Greek speaking people. When they spoke, that's what it sounded like to them. It just sounded like barbar. So the word barbarian kind of just originated out of that. But then Paul says that he is a debtor both to the wise and the unwise. You know, the thing about the gospel is it's for everybody. It can humble the most brilliant intellect, and it can elevate the simplest mind. It's an amazing thing. And we find all throughout history, there have been both the wise and the unwise. There have been the highly educated. There have been the extremely intelligent, the intellectually brilliant minds that have embraced the gospel and embraced Christ as a little child would. And we could go through a long list of people like that. And right down to this very day, there are many highly intelligent, highly educated people in our world today who are believers in Jesus Christ. But then, of course, the most simple-minded person can also receive Christ and know the gospel and be given understanding by God that actually increases their capacities mentally and so forth. I've met so many people who, on the one hand, are very simple in that they've never really been educated to speak of, or they're not really cultured people necessarily, but you find in them and their love for Jesus and the simplicity of that love, sometimes you find a wisdom and a brilliance that's just shocking. I've had this experience over and over again, just listening to somebody and hearing the wisdom that's pouring out of their mouths and thinking, wow, I know this person. I know their background. I know where they came from. And I know that the Lord taught them this stuff. That's what God does. And it's such a wonderful thing. And this is where Paul's at. He's ready to minister to anybody and everybody. He's ready to go to Mars Hill and speak to the philosophers. He's ready to be in the household of Caesar. speaking to the servants in Caesar's home, but he's also perfectly happy to go along the riverside there in Philippi and minister to Lydia and those few women that are there. He's happy to reach out to the jailer later that during that same time there. And as Paul would say about himself, that he went about ministering to small and to great, because the gospel is for everyone. And doesn't matter how brilliant you are, doesn't matter how educated you are, you will find in the gospel depths you can never fathom. You will find things that all of your learning could never even begin to compare to. And in the gospel for the simple person, God will take that person and raise them to heights that are sometimes just amazing. Sometimes absolutely amazing. So, this is where Paul's at. He is a debtor to the Greeks, the barbarians, to the wise, to the unwise. And here it is. So, as much as is in me, I am ready to preach the gospel to you who are in Rome also. So Paul says, I want to come. I've been wanting to come. I have been praying to come. I've been hindered, but I want to be there. And this is what I want to do ultimately. I want to come and preach the gospel to you. Now, this is interesting to me. Because although, of course, Paul would have had a desire to preach the gospel to the masses of unbelievers in Rome, remember who he's addressing here. He's not addressing unbelievers. He's writing this letter to those who are loved by God, those who are called by God. He's writing this letter to the saints. He's saying to the believers, I want to come to Rome to preach the gospel to you. Now, the reason that I find that interesting is because we generally think of preaching as being directed toward unbelievers. And we think of teaching as being primarily directed toward the saints. And that is true to some extent. But I think based on what Paul says here, there's also a place for preaching to believers. And that's what he is desiring to do. And so from this statement, it's obvious that Paul's idea of preaching the gospel includes more than stating certain historical facts about Jesus Christ to the unconverted. This is indeed preaching the gospel. And to some degree, that is what the four evangelists, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, did. But it's apparent from Paul's epistles that preaching the gospel, now here's the point, preaching the gospel, according to Paul, also includes explaining to the converted the full implication of those facts. See, Paul says, I want to come to Rome to you believers, to you Christians. I want to come and preach the gospel to you. Paul's desire was to give the Christians there a full exposition of the facts concerning Jesus Christ and what he accomplished through his death and resurrection. That's what Paul wanted to do. He wanted to go there and basically tell them everything that he knew. He wanted them to have a full orbed understanding of the gospel. He did not want their understanding to be lacking. He didn't want it to be undimensional. He wanted it to be multidimensional. He wanted them to understand all of the implications of this gospel of Christ dying for their sins and rising from the dead. You know, it's amazing, and we'll talk about this in the next study, but it's really amazing how little gospel is necessary to get a person saved. It's amazing. I mean, there's such dynamite in the smallest portions of the gospel. I have heard stories, testimonies of people who have gotten saved on the smallest amount of information. Now, some people would say, oh, that can't happen. I think it can. Because remember, God is the one who's behind this gospel. And it's just, you know, just one little seed getting in. But, okay, so here's a person. They get saved on a very little amount of the gospel. And then, what needs to happen? Well, they need to begin to grow. And of course, they obviously need to go beyond that small seed of understanding. They need to begin to fully comprehend all that this actually means and implies. That's what Paul's talking about. I want to come to Rome. I want to make sure that you understand all of the implications. I know you know that Christ died on the cross for your sins. I know you know he rose from the dead, but I want to come and tell you what that means. What it means in its deepest sense. That's what he's really communicating to the believers in Rome. And he will shortly begin to do that. But as we wrap things up tonight, one last thing to just touch on, and it's Rome itself. Twice here in these verses, Paul has spoken specifically of Rome, or three times. And the question that I want to bring before you is, what was Rome like? We know it was the capital of the world at the time. It was the great empire that dominated the whole of the Mediterranean world, and for all practical purposes, it was the ruling power on the earth. Some people would say, oh, but you know, in the Orient, there were the Chinese dynasties and all of that. This is true. But Rome, for all practical purposes, ruled the world. So we know about the great engineering minds. We know about the great transportation system that the Romans developed, the roads that they made throughout the known world. We know about the aqueducts. We know about Roman law and how we even operate to some extent from it today. We know about the great structures. You can even go to Rome today, and some of those great buildings from back in this period of time are still standing today. We can see the Colosseum and different places like that. So we know all of that about Rome. But the question that I think is more pertinent is, what was Rome like morally? What was Rome like morally? Well, of course, Rome, we've also heard that it was decadent and it was a very morally corrupted culture, which is true. You could always find exceptions to the rule, no doubt. You could always find good people here and there. But generally speaking, morally, Rome was about as corrupt as anything could ever be. And I would venture to say that it was more corrupt than what we know of corruption today. We're doing our best to get there ourselves, but we haven't quite gotten there yet, thank God. But just a couple of things, and there's a reason that I want to close with this, but just a couple of insights. We can find one right here in the first chapter in verses 29 through 31, which we'll get to later. Paul kind of gives a general description of life at the time in Rome and, of course, throughout that whole region of the world. It would have been true everywhere. How did he describe it? He said that it was filled with every kind of wickedness, evil, greed, and depravity, envy, murder, strife, deceit, and malice. There was gossip, slander, God-haters, people who were insolent, arrogant, and boastful, those who invented ways of doing evil, those who were disobedient to their parents. They are senseless, faithless, heartless, and ruthless. That is a general description of the condition of the culture at the time of the writing of this epistle. Suetonius, the biographer of the emperors, wrote these things about a number of the emperors. And gets a little bit racy, but I think we need to know where they were at. Tiberius. Remember, Tiberius was in power when Jesus was ministering and crucified. Tiberius often had nude women wait on the tables at which he dined. He also had male and female prostitutes openly engage in group sex as entertainment for his pleasure. It was also said that he surrounded himself with young boys that he used sexually. Caligula lived a licentious life and was given to habitual incest with his sisters. He loved to engage in sex while he ate, and he often had people tortured during many of his sexual escapades. Nero had at least two boys, Sporus and Pythagoras, with whom he engaged in regular sexual activity. Galba, Nero's successor, had at least one male lover. Titus loved to party with the catamites. Catamites were the young boys used for homosexual pleasure, and the eunuchs. Hadrian had numerous affairs with women, but also had a young man named Antonius as his sexual companion. Commodus, along with 300 concubines, also had 300 young boys to satisfy his sexual appetite. Heterosexual and homosexual depictions were openly portrayed on household items such as frescoes, lamps, bowls, and cups. One historian said, "Imagine drinking from an elegant silver cup with scenes of male-to-male intercourse on it, or visiting someone's house and seeing fresco paintings depicting sexual activity on the walls of the best rooms." Now, we have examples that still exist today of these things in Pompeii. So, what do we see here? We see that the Romans conquered the world, but they could not conquer their own lust and were ultimately consumed by it. Sounds like the Europeans, sounds like the British, sounds like the Americans. But this is my point. This is why I share this. This is the world the apostles were sent out into with the gospel. This is the world they went into. You see, what's happening in our culture today is we are just drifting back. You know, there's a group of political people today that call themselves progressives. They think that we're moving forward. No, no. Be clear about one thing. We're not going forward at all. We're going backward. We're going backward. We're going back into paganism. We're going back into heathenism. And as you go back into paganism, as the cultural effects of Christianity begin to disappear, you're seeing all of these things that were prevalent at the time that Jesus came and sent the apostles out into the world. You're seeing them resurface once again. So the world that we are living in and moving deeper into is a world that is very much like the world of the apostles' days. This is the environment, secondly, that a church was birthed in. This is the environment. You see, I think in some ways we become too sanitized because we've had this wonderful experience of such a great influence of Christianity upon the culture. It has sanitized the culture to a large degree, but that is disappearing rapidly, as we can all see. But I think what's happened too in the church, and it's not as bad today as it was in previous generations, but we still have sort of a sanitized view of culture, and we still think it should be a certain way. This is the way it is. This is the way it always has been, without God, without Christ, without the gospel. But this is what the gospel is for. It's for these kinds of cultures. It's for these kinds of people. That's why there was a church that was birthed in Rome, because that's where the sin was. That's where all the people were. That's where the gospel has its greatest impact. And so these are the people that Paul was anxious to preach the gospel to. So what am I saying? I'm saying this. There's a good chance that things are never going to get better morally in our country. There's a good chance that things are going to continue to slide into depravity. But this is what we need to know. It's in the darkest places that the light of the gospel shines the brightest. And as our world continues to drift back into heathenism and all of its accompanying perversity, may we, like Paul, continue to boldly proclaim Christ and him crucified as man's only hope. You see, that's what we have to understand today. These debauched rulers that we're reading about, and you know, generally speaking, as the leaders go, so go the people. When you see cultures that are inundated with all of this kind of perversity and all of this, know this, that where sin abounded, another quote for Romans, where sin abounded, grace abounded much more. And Paul wanted to go to Rome just like we would want to go somewhere where we hear of dark, dark places where God is doing a great work and the light is shining brightly. We're like, yeah, man, I love hearing those reports. I love hearing those stories of how God's working in those places. That's how Paul was. I want to go to Rome, that center of decadence, that center of perversion, that center of all wickedness. I want to go there and preach the gospel because that's where the gospel does its greatest work among sinners. So let's remember that as we study Romans and as we live in this world that's sliding deeper and deeper into depravity, we've got the answer. Nobody else does. We've got the answer. The answer is the gospel of Jesus Christ, which is the power of God to salvation for everyone who believes, and that is what we'll pick up on next week.